Randy Mosher joins me this week to discuss his upcoming book, Your Tasting Brain. This is Beersmith Podcast number 292.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 292, and it's mid-November 2023. Randy Mosher joins me this week to discuss his upcoming book called Your Tasting Brain. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They invite you to join their upcoming brewery workshop, March 24th through the 27th in Austin, Texas. This one-of-a-kind event brings together professional brewers to help you start or grow your own craft brewery. To learn more, please visit breweryworkshop.com. Again, that is breweryworkshop.com. And also the American Homebrewers Association. The Homebrewers Association invites you to join today and get a bonus book. Join for 1 year and select from a free brewing book for more than 60 titles to match your fermentation goals. Visit homebrewersassociation.org to join the American Homebrewers Association today and treat yourself to a new brewing book. And I'm celebrating 20 years of Beersmith brewing software with a sale. I launched version 1.0 of Beersmith way back in fall of 2003, so this is my 20th year in business. I'm running a Black Friday sale until the 28th of November. To celebrate, visit beersmith.com to take advantage of 20% off on Beersmith desktop and Beersmith web. And finally, a reminder to click that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Randy Mosher. Randy is the author of the books Mastering Homebrew, Radical Brewing, and Tasting Beer. He's also a partner at two breweries near Chicago. The first one's Five Rabbit, and the second is Forbidden Root. Randy, it's great to have you on the show. How are you doing today?
Great, Brad. Great to be here. I'm doing well.
A pleasure. Before we dive in this week's topics, can you tell us a little bit about how the two breweries are doing? I know you had one closed for a little bit.
It's closed right now. We're still hoping to get a brew pub open sometime, but I'm not really sure what the timeline is. You know, like a lot of breweries, we've had a couple close in Chicago here this week, including a real heartbreaker, Metropolitan Brewing.
Kidding. You know, didn't you do all the artwork for them?
Yeah. But they've got in a terrible situation with their landlord and just couldn't get it fixed. They've been working on it for really, since they moved into the new place. They've been trying to get to some sustainable deal with the landlord, and they just never did. So they're, you know, who knows if they'll ever reopen. They say they are not going to, but it's a real shame. But we're hanging in. You know, it's just difficult times for small breweries. We're proud of the work we're doing. We're making some fantastic beers, like so many people. But seems like business is coming back a little bit now after COVID. People are going out a little more, spending a little more. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it's a challenge. I think last year it was really close on the number of breweries opening and closing, whereas previous to that, it had been, you know, just stellar growth for many, many years. So,
yeah, well, that kind of thing can't grow forever. You know, there's just a limit.
Yeah, I think we're up to like 9,400 breweries or something like that. It's quite a few.
Close to 10,000.
Well, I believe you just submitted your latest book to the publisher. The title is Your Tasting Brain. Can you tell us a little bit about the upcoming book?
Yeah, I was excited to get it done finally. I spent over 4 years of pretty close to full-time work on this project. And the idea is it was just basically like I had a lot of questions about our sensory system and really how does it all work? How do the parts and pieces work? How do they coordinate together? And I pitched this book to several publishers, but we got a lot of interest from the University of Chicago Press. So that's our publisher. And it was important for me to have an academic publisher because this is really, it's not an academic book, but it's a book based on science And so everything is footnoted and it's out right now for peer review for, you know, various subject matter experts to make sure I got everything right. So I'm a little nervous, but hopefully people are interested in having this book be out there for everybody. And I'm happy for the opportunity to make things better. So, it's going to be big. My publisher's a little worried about how big it is.
I was going to say, so contrast this with your previous book. You wrote a book on tasting beer, obviously.
Yes.
And this one's your tasting brain. So I assume it goes into more depth and probably covers a broader subject than just beer, right?
Yeah. Well, it really starts right out with the chemical senses, they call them, taste, mouthfeel, which they technically call trigeminal based on the name of the nerve, which includes, you know, all kinds of chemical irritation and chemically induced heat and cold and texture that you can feel in your mouth, like creaminess and smoothness and coarseness, things like that. And then smell. And then once you sort of figure out what's going on with those, how do they start to interact together in the brain? And ultimately, you get all the way down to real cognitive stuff like behavior and valuation and things like price and scarcity and how does all that affect your perception. And it does pretty strongly, actually.
That's pretty cool. First, can we dive into the basic senses? Obviously, we have taste on the tongue. We have smell. As you mentioned, there's other senses that are involved in sort of providing this overall sensation we call taste or flavor, I guess.
Yeah. Well, taste is the one that's the easiest to grasp, I would say, because it's sweet, sour, salty, and bitter. Those are the primary ones. There's a fifth, they call the fifth flavor or fifth taste called umami. It's a little more difficult to pin down. When you know it, you know it. You know, the current craze for ramen right now, that's 100% based on umami. Mm-hmm. Right, because that's what all that bone broth is, all those long stewing, long cooking processes. But umami doesn't really function on its own. It needs aroma to make it work. So it's inherently kind of, it's a taste, but it's also sort of a multimodal, they call it, you know, where at least two senses kind of come together to make something called flavor. And so if you take away the aroma component, it sort of falls apart and it doesn't really taste like much. Some of the mechanics are surprisingly complex. There are three different salt measuring systems that are operative in mammals. In humans, we only have two because there's another one that's sort of a mechanistic system that when animals get salt depleted, they're just forced to find salt. And they don't have any choice about it. Where in human beings, we do a lot of things with our cognitive brains that other animals do that sort of more or less by instinct or by sort of force. And then, so taste is, and sour has a couple of different things. They think fat is a taste, but they're not 100% sure. So it's always sort of listed as tentative. Carbonation and wet are also taste. They involve taste buds and a particular enzyme that's involved in carbonation and things. And but of all the senses, it's pretty easy to grasp. Mm-hmm. When you get to mouthfeel, again, we know what mouthfeel is. If you like chocolate or you like things that are creamy or things that are fizzy, you know, those are all mouthfeel elements. Also, chemical heat and chemical cold. So if you're a chili head, the chemical in the chilies actually stimulates the same exact receptor cells that respond to heat. So we call it heat because it's virtually indistinguishable for heat because it's the same cells sending the same signals to the brain. And the same is true for cool. So menthol creates this sort of cooling sensation that is sent to the brain from the same cells that would sense coolness in the like an ice cube in your mouth. It's exactly the same. So, and then all the things around fatty, creamy, you know, are based on either viscosity or the ability of lubrication. of things to slide over one another, which is different than viscosity, just sort of means thickness. Yeah. Whereas that lubrication factor you get with fats and things is an important thing too. So there's quite complicated systems. There's like, I think in mouthfeel, there's like seven independent, well, they're separate systems that sort of all work together, but it's quite a lot of different parts and pieces to make that system work. And then you get to smell, which is completely nuts.
Which is insanely complicated, if I recall.
It's so right? complicated. Yeah, well, basically, the smell system of smell has to be able to smell any chemical, right? And any chemical that has the right amount of volatility in any given atmosphere can be smelled. And even things we think of as odorless, like natural gas, if you get that, like they found that they had people on a deep sea dive and they gave them some methane to smell, and at huge amount of pressure that they were under in a diving bell, they could actually smell the methane because it wasn't volatilizing, or it wasn't like just boiling off immediately. So we have 391 different types of olfactory receptors. And compared to mice, for example, and rats, they have about 1,200. But the difference is humans have many more devoted to food. We have many less devoted to what are called behavioral smells, which are things that are like pheromones that drive certain behavior around fear, predator response, sexual activities, aggression, avoidance of aggression, things like that, that there's a huge amount of those chemicals that need to be sensed. And those send signals to the brain that just prompt instant action that the animals do not have a choice on.
I'm thinking like my dog. I think I was reading somewhere that dogs spend about a third of their brain is spent processing just their nose, right?
It could well be. I've never seen that figure, but it's not that they're processing it. It's they're responding to it.
Yeah.
Right. So those signals in those with those behavioral smells, those are not something they ponder. Right. We have that ability to think about them and create from them and use them to make beer and to make food and to make wine, and animals with half of their smells that they're capable, well, of half of their receptors, they just do what they are told. So if they smell a predator, they freeze instantly, and they don't have any choice in it, because that's the behavior that's required when you smell a predator. And, you know, because that's the evolution has determined that's the most effective way to stay out of trouble when there's a predator around, is to play dead or just not move, you know. So and we also have a huge amount of our olfactories to receptors devoted to food odors, and we have a lot more multiple copies of food sensing receptors than animals do, because again, we have a complex diet. We can eat almost anything. We can eat meat, we can eat fish, we can eat all kind of plant materials and things, so we encompass the full range of things. Think about a koala. What do they eat? Eucalyptus leaves. Right, so they don't need that much of a system. Like dogs can't smell, dogs can't taste sweet because they don't. There's nothing in their diet that would be sweet, right? So everything ultimately just gets adapted to the lifestyle of whatever the creature is, us included, and we just happen to have a lifestyle that's very complex and that's also driven by our cognitive brains, and so we choose to do things that other animals just would really have no choice to. So people always say, oh, we're just not as good as rats and mice and bears and things, but it's just not a matter of good or bad. It's just they're suited for what they do. We can't do what a bear does. A bear can't do what we do, you know, so we should not feel bad. We should not feel bad about, you know, what we perceive as our limitations, because we have a lot of capabilities. We're actually really, really good in this area.
How much of our sense is actually dedicated to food avoidance, like trying to avoid bad food, for example?
Not that much.
Not much.
The trigeminal system. Part of the trigeminal system is avoiding hazards.
Yeah.
And it's a real. It has a lot of priority in the brain. It signals We don't habituate to its signals. When we smell something that's irritating, the next time we smell it more strongly, right? So it gets stronger and stronger. It's like a buzzer going off. So we smell a solventy smell, for example, or
sour
gasoline
milk or
natural, sour milk, so acidity, bitterness. Well, not that, but like solventy things that make your eyes water, or smoke, for example.
Yeah,
it's a great example. Carbon dioxide, right? CO2 triggers receptors that are sort of irritation sensing receptors, and that's why you open up a can of cola, and if you got your nose too close to it, it'll make you sneeze. That's an involuntary reaction to expel that carbon dioxide, because it's actually kind of toxic. Or it's harmful because it can suffocate you, I guess.
Yeah.
Taste. We have sweet is we're hardwired for taste, just like all other animals are. We love it, love it, love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. Kind of too much. We love fat. Same deal. So we have a lot of problems in a world where we're not hunters and gatherers. We're fat and sugar, salt too, are available in whatever quantities we decide to stuff in our pie holes, right?
Yeah.
And so, and big business knows that. Frito-Lay and everybody that makes grocery store food, they're well aware of this equation, and they've optimized everything to give maximum pleasure and seek maximum kind of repurchase for those things. And it's just business. That's what they do. But it's sort of like we're not that well adapted to now in this modern industrialized world of food. We have a lot of problems with diabetes and high blood pressure and all of that because we crave those things. And then you get to sourness, and it's sort of like, I don't know about this sour. It sort of like raises alarms a little bit. You can learn to love it for sure. Babies don't like it very much, but by the time kids get to be 4 or 5 years old, they crave it like crazy. You see all the sour heads, warheads, Sour Patch Kids, all those sour candies. They love them. And that's purely acquired taste. Animals don't do that. That's us. That's our cognitive brain saying, okay, well, we'll like this. Same with bitter. It turns out that people who like bitter beer, like IPA, are not less sensitive to bitterness. They're actually more sensitive to bitterness than average. And the reason they like the bitterness is because they tend to be sensation-seeking individuals, right? That's a personality type for people who just want more sensation. They want to, like, hit me, right? And that's why IPA lovers just statistically tend to be a little more male-oriented than female-oriented, because males tend to be a little bit more sensation-seeking on average than females as a group.
Well, overall, our sense of taste is not static, but in fact, it changes throughout the day, depending on a whole bunch of different conditions. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the factors that affect how we taste things?
Yeah, taste is like the trigeminal. We have very little difference between, but like that's very stable because it's so defensive. Taste is intermediate. It's generally pretty defensive. There's a lot of redundancy built into that system. And it doesn't vary that much, but where we have a lot of variation is in smell, because we have 391 receptors, right? And the way our brain interprets smells is that even any one molecule, it might trigger responses from a half a dozen or a dozen different receptor cells that will then create a pattern and present the pattern to the brain, and the brain looks at it and it either recognizes it or it doesn't recognize it, and then that eventually finds its way into memory, and like that pattern becomes sort of our memory trace of the thing. And so with that many receptors, and we have multiple copies of many of those receptors, then we and some of those copies come in sensitive versions and insensitive versions. It does happen in taste as well. There's a phenomenon that they call super taster. It's not really the best word for it, because it implies that these people have superior sense of taste, which is not really true. But what they do have, about 20% of the population has an elevated sensitivity to the groups of bitter chemicals that you'd find in broccoli and that family of vegetables. And so they have a lot of sensitivity. They also tend to, because they have more papillae on their tongue, they also tend to be more sensitive to irritation from trigeminal things, and especially alcohol. So people who are, they call, who they call super tasters, they tend to be, they prefer sweet, they hate bitter, and they're not that crazy about alcohol unless there's some sweetness to it, because it tends to be perceived as irritating to them. And so that's, and that's possible because sweet is a very small group of chemicals that, well, medium-sized group of chemicals, but it relies on only two receptors, and there's not variations in those two receptors. Sweet has a receptor, or I'm sorry, sour has a receptor, salt has a couple receptors in separate systems, and but bitterness has 26 different bitter receptors, because in order to sense, bitterness encompasses an enormous range of different chemical types, and in order to have the ability to sense, chemically sense all these up, it takes 26 different bitter receptor types to do that. And like smell, some of those come in sensitive and not very sensitive versions, and we have multiple copies. So you might have, so the super tasters, they have two sensitive copies. What they call the non-tasters, who are really insensitive to bitterness of that type, have two completely insensitive copies. And most of us, a little more than half, have one of each, one highly sensitive, one not very sensitive. And that tends to be kind of the pattern. You'll find, you know, with a smell, there's very few smells that people are completely, that some people are completely blind to, because most smells we can smell with multiple receptor types. And so if one receptor type, you don't have a sensitive one, you probably have some other ones that are sensitive. And so that for you becomes your pattern. And, you know, those are patterns that are learned, not inborn.
I found it interesting too. I think as you get older, do these things change much? Actually, most of our senses, of course, degrade. Your hearing gets worse, eyesight gets worse, and so on.
Yeah, it's true for that as well. You know, after about age 80 is where it really starts to decline more noticeably. I think, you know, I'm 70 right now. I can smell just fine. I haven't noticed, you know, help with the Master Cicerone exam and taste those panels along with everybody else. And, you know, I'm not the hottest taster in the room, but I'm not bad. I'm holding my own. But taste, like the whole tasting process is so dependent on attention and experience and kind of training and keeping yourself refreshed on all of this stuff, that you can really compensate for quite a bit with just by paying attention and you know, being really highly engaged in. So anybody thinks that they can't, that they're like, everybody thinks they're terrible. You're not terrible. You just think you're terrible. And so as long as you think you're terrible, then you have an excuse for not paying attention, because, well, I'm terrible, so it doesn't really matter. But, you know, get out there and pay attention. I talked to somebody I think it was at New Belgium, and she said that for their sensory panels, they like to hire people who literally are the people who smell the roses, right? Because it's that engagement, that paying attention, caring about it. That's what really is the main thing that makes a difference. You can learn everything else, but you have to want to do it.
Well, as you've noted in your book, the brain makes some things more difficult. For example, our olfactory system is really good at identifying patterns, but then it turns those patterns into impressions, stories, memories that we can share. How does that whole process take place?
Well, it's really fascinating, because you've got all these 391 receptors. And again, on any given smell, you might activate a couple of dozen or so. There are a few smells that just have one receptor. They're still working out which receptors and which smells. So this is still a work in progress. So, but for most smells, it creates this very complex pattern of responses. There's positive responses, there's negative responses. The receptors actually fight with each other for binding to smells and things. It's a really dynamic, active environment. And in the end, they put up a a grid, more or less, of response, a pattern to the brain that goes into the bottom of the olfactory bulb.
Uh-huh.
So the olfactory bulb is a little piece of your brain about the size of the end of your little finger, maybe not even that big. And all of the olfactory receptors are all wired up like a switchboard, and they're sorted out by their type, and then those go into the bottom of the olfactory bulb. And there's a lot of processing that happens. It's just two sets of nerves that go from the bottom to the top. But along the way, there's all these nerves that interact with the brain and interact with things lower. And at the end, what comes in is a pattern based on chemistry, that it's actually deterministic based on what the actual mix and quantities of chemicals are that creates the pattern. But by the time it comes out, the brain throws all of that away. The chemistry is absolutely and utterly lost when it enters the brain.
So I'm thinking like a spectrometer, like if you looked at a spectrometer on a given material, it would give you a certain pattern, right, that would match that.
Yeah.
The chemistry for the material. So that's what's going into this thing. But as you mentioned, all that data gets dumped.
It gets dumped because we can't use it. It's too much. Think about the amount of information. You got two dozen receptors, let's say. Each one of them can be a null response, a positive response, a negative response. And then multiple levels of intensity, orders of magnitude of intensity. So you have this enormous amount of data. The brain can't handle that amount of data. So it takes that and it turns it into a like what they call an aroma object, right? So the aroma, so what comes out is the aroma object. And your brain, the hippocampus is your filing, the sort of master filing system for the brain.
Okay.
It doesn't store anything itself, but it's like the card catalog in the library. It knows where all the parts and pieces are. It knows where all the books are. It knows like everything. And so when the smell comes into the brain, it fairly quickly hits the hippocampus, and the hippocampus is like, oh, I got a clue here. I have a memory. I got a memory coming. I've triggered a memory. And so that then it will send a file card down to the systems that are right above the olfactory bulb and say, how about this? Let's say, how about it's dark chocolate? Is that it? And the brain's like, nope, that's not it. Okay, how about it? How about this? This is coffee. How about that? Is that it? And the brain will be, yeah, that's coffee. And so now, and if the brain doesn't ultimately recognize it, it starts a new card. Right. Mm-hmm. So because we have to be able to learn new things too,
of course, yeah,
as we go along. Right. So this, it's an incredible system. It really is quite well. It's just very logical. It makes complete sense. But so what that means is like we smell things in a way that scientists call configural smelling. Right. And what that means is that sense that the chemistry comes in, but the chemistry doesn't make it to the brain. Stories make it to the brain. Memories, associations, context, purpose, tasks, hedonics, those are all the things that are on those cards, right? And so if you think about a product like a cola, when you smell a cola, you open a can of cola and you smell cola. You don't smell nutmeg, cinnamon, lime peel, lemon juice, orange blossom.
Cocoa, whatever, yeah.
And I think that's about it. And like you take those things and you put them together in exactly the right proportions, and you can't pick them out in a cola. Now, guys who are people who are flavorists who work with cola formulas all day long, they can absolutely pick it out because they've been trained to. They know exactly what's in there. They know what the nutmeg note is, what the cinnamon note is, you know, all of that. But mere mortals. You know, we're just not, you have to learn all that. You have to train yourself to do that. It's very specialized. So, and that's, and hops are configural. Beer is configural. You know, esters create this sort of configural thing. It's like, you can't pick out individual chemicals like hops. There's something like 1200 terpenoids, which are the main aroma chemicals that are present in hops. There's 1200 of them in beer.
Wow.
None of them smell like beer. There's not a single one of those that smells exactly like hops. Well, it smells exactly like hops. Together, they blend together in various ways to get to this configuration that the brain recognizes as hoppy.
Does it taste, I was just asking, does the taste work the same way? And, you know, you're talking about the sense of, texture, I guess?
Taste does not. Taste, sweet, sour, salty, bitter, umami, those really maintain themselves really separately.
But the brain doesn't merge those together to create an overall flavor sensation, I guess,
smell? No. There are different little places in your brain. There's a place for sweet. There's a place for sour. There's a place for bitter.
Yeah.
So there's like these little thick when they, you know, do brain scans, fMRIs and things, they do these scans and different things light up depending. So they're not integrated together, you know.
Interesting. So, but they're not, our brain doesn't integrate them with the smell to create the overall flavor, I guess.
They do, but that's later. So that comes a little bit later. Yeah. That's what flavor is, right? So that's smell, taste, mouthfeel, and, you know, also seems to have cognitive stuff like is this a really expensive bottle of wine or a really cheap bottle of wine?
So how does this flow up all the way to the cognitive level where we actually start acting and talking about the flavors?
Well, that's just what everything does in the brain, right? So it's like this waterfall that things go up and things go down. And at every level, they go up. Every level you go up, there's some signal going back down too, right? So it forms these loops. Like at the very bottom, let's say taste is whether you will taste something and swallow it versus spit it out and gag, right? That's decided by your brainstem, right? The brainstem is at the very base of the brain. It's just a swelling, right, of where the spine comes up out of the backbone and comes into the brain. It swells out, and that's the oldest part of your brain is that brainstem. So why would we let that determine what we like or not? Well, we do because it acts really, really rapidly. It's very fast because it's simple, right? It doesn't have to think about it. It just acts.
So but I think if I pour like a glass of apple juice and it's actually floor polish or something like that, right?
Yeah,
you'll spit it right out.
Like, spit it like this facial expression.
Yeah,
that is like gag reflex. It's expulsion, right? That's to expel bad things, and all those muscle contractions. That's what that does. Let's see. I know I had a thought here.
I would say work your way up the loop now. So that's at the lowest level. What happens at the next level?
Well, the next level, like at first you get. First you get smell and you get that involvement of the hippocampus for memory. And right next to the hippocampus is a little house of pain and pleasure that they call the amygdala. And so the amygdala is like, do I like this? Do I not like this? Right. And it's the one end of the amygdala hates stuff and is very painful and unpleasant. And the other end of the amygdala is happy, happy, happy. And so, but also like very quickly, smell and trigeminal, you know, mouthfeel stuff merges together, smell and taste merge together in the insula, and then eventually, you know, these combined multimodal signals start to make their way into the prefrontal cortex, which is this thinking part of your brain up here, you know. Smell is really not hardwired for us at all. It's completely based on learning. And and for a lot of animals, when they're not hungry, they can't smell anything, right? They can't smell food when they're not hungry because they don't need to smell food when they're satiated. But humans, we can smell food. We just don't have to have it, right? We know when we're full and we can stop eating, even though there's food there, because we might wander by a tree full of really beautiful fruit and we're not hungry, but we know we will be tomorrow, right? So our cognitive brain makes a note of that and puts that in our little map of our environment and says, aha, here's a food source. Maybe I want to come back to that sometime when I'm hungry. You know, when animals don't like lower, like hate to call them lower because they're all wonderful, but other mammals don't have that ability.
Interesting. Well, you mentioned a couple minutes ago you'd done some work on the complexity of wines, beer, and foods. Why are beer and wine even a little more complicated to process than most of other foods we enjoy?
I don't know that they are. Wine typically, it's hard to know like the actual numbers. Most of the estimates on how many chemicals are in a glass of wine seem to be in the 600 to 1,000 range.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like they wine people feel that's plenty complicated. And it is. That's a lot. But beer, we have 1,200 terpenoids alone in, wow. in just from the hops. And we have, so one of the ways I started thinking about, because I'm a beer guy, I'm trying to write about wine. You know, what am I going to say about wine? And because there's been an awful lot said about wine. But I had some really basic questions about wine that I didn't ever have answers. I've got a lot of wine books, and I've traveled a little, gone to wine regions. I think wine's interesting, but I just had a lot of questions. And so one of the things that got me going is they do some experiments now that, like, the current thing is to basically create a model wine. They call them, they'll analyze a wine, see what flavors are in there that are important, that are present in quantities. Where they should matter, and then they rebuild a fake wine that replicates the original wine. And they can usually do that in a white wine with maybe about 15 to 20 different chemicals along with kind of a base, and with red wine it's about 25 or so. With beer it's about 40. Because if you think of, like, wine has I've sort of started diagramming these beverages and foods by, it's sort of a bubble diagram. So you've got one bubble that's basically ester, right? So this is the fruity bubble,
fruity, yeah.
Right? And so one of the things they found when they started doing these reconstitution experiments is that they looked at an ester pool that had 14 esters in a white wine, and they wondered what would happen if they took away six of those. So they did that, and they found there was absolutely no change in the overall smell of the wine. They could take out six esters, and it still smelled just as fruity. And then they thought, well, what if we take all of them out? We'll just leave one. And they found out that really didn't make much difference either. That one fruity ester was about as good as another. And that those, but it took a lot more of that one, based on its based on what the total combined impact would have been on all the others. They had to use six times as much to get the same intensity, because all those esters are positively reinforcing each other.
Of course, yeah.
You know, so beer, so wine has a ester pool, wine has a woody pool, wine has sometimes some taints and troubles and things like corky, moldy smells and other kinds of fermentation problems and things like that. But beer has, we have a fermentation pool too, because wine doesn't get its fruitiness directly from grapes. Yeast makes the fruitiness during fermentation, because wine doesn't have wine grapes don't have any esters in them. They have fatty acids that the yeast will turn into esters with the alcohol. And then beer has a cooked flavor pool, which is that Maillard chemistry, and also caramelization, which is a somewhat different process. But, you know, all these flavors, like everything related to bread, cookie, cake, toffee, caramel, nuts.
Yeah, we did an episode on that.
All that stuff.
Together,
yeah,
I think, last episode.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. So, and that's also a big pool. There's a lot of those chemicals. They're very impactful in beer. It really almost defines, like, why beer is so different, because that's the only fermented beverage that really has that pool. And of course, there's some odds and ends that beer has, and taints and troubles as well, oxidation flavors, staling flavors, things like that. So beer has just more different aspects. So one of the things that makes it so stunningly great with food, because rather than just having this fruitiness and a woodiness to pull from, we've got flavors that you actually find in food, like hoppy, floral and citrusy kind of things, and grassy stuff, some grassy notes occasionally, and then all these wonderful cooked flavors, which of course most food is cooked. And so we have a lot of these things when we're looking to try and make connections. We have these pools of flavors that we're able to go to for that.
Interesting. Well, you've also, I think in your book, you mentioned that smells dump like a fire hose, was the word you used. Directly, yeah. Into the limbic system, which is kind of our emotional system, which in some ways makes judging beer even harder, right?
Yeah, it just can be overwhelming, and it's just like you got to recognize that your sense of smell is a little different. And I think for a very long time, the sense of smell was regarded kind of as something a little bit scary, because it can trigger these memories, and it can, and it, like I said, it really does come into the brain in a different way. There's this little thing right smack dab in the center of your head called the thalamus, right? And okay. So the thalamus has an up and a down and a back and a front. It's like a three-dimensional thing. And all other senses go through the thalamus and register where they're at. And because the thalamus is sort of like a calculator that the cognitive brain uses to make judgments based on, okay, if I'm on this branch and I want to jump over to that tree and grab that fruit, like, what's the calculation there? You know, it's really that muscle, the thing that helps create muscle memory that eventually gets loaded into the cognitive brain and stored there for action, right? Mm-hmm. And smell does not go through the thalamus because smell has nothing to offer, right?
Really?
If you think about a smoke curl coming off a cigar, you know, going up in the room, and that smoke curl, that's the shape of aroma. Right. And depending upon where you're at on any given second, that smell might be close, might be far away. You don't know where it is. You don't have any point of reference on it. Mm-hmm. And so the thalamus just doesn't have any, it gains nothing by taking in smell. And the other thing is that many other systems, like the visual system, the visual has like four or five stages of processing, layers of neurons. That looks for lines, it looks for shapes, it looks for front and back and up and, you know, and depth, and it analyzes visual signals in stages. And at each stage, it sends some of that information up to the cognitive brain, and the cognitive brain sends some stuff down to it. And so there's like these loop-de-loops coming. And so the brain is able to break the visual thing down into parts and pieces that the cognitive brain can better understand when it's trying to look at something unknown and doesn't know what it is. Whereas because smell doesn't have that processing that gives partial processing and then up to the cognitive brain and then a little more and then a little more and then a little more, it just like squirts in with this configural thing, like the whole thing all at once. You get emotion, but you can't break it down. You can't break that Coca-Cola down into its component parts.
So doesn't it also,
information is just not there.
Doesn't it also trigger memories a lot of times without a lot of context? I mean, you get this memory triggered from a smell, perhaps, and you don't really know why.
Yeah, famously. But that's like as a taster, that outside of just being motivated and interested, genuinely interested, that's your greatest tool. Because inside your head is like this little monkey that's your inner taster, right? And that taster knows what stuff is, and you got to let it talk, you know? So if you're afraid to speak, you know, if you're afraid to blurt out some dumbass thing, you know, you're not gonna, it's trying to help you. Right. So those memories. So like if you can get a little memory like that and linger in that, say, oh, I just felt like I was in a candy store. Well, what might be in a candy store? And, you know, start thinking, is it bubble gum? Is it banana runts? Is it like, what is it? And like banana flavor candy will automatically. And there's a chemical that's called isoamyl acetate that's found in fermentations. That's one of the more important esters. That's a fermentation ester. It's in all fermented beverages and distilled ones too. And if you get a whiff of that individually, that'll put you back to some kind of candy, whatever your generation's version of it was. And that's just a great example of those things. So whatever, like, we were at a champagne tasting, my wife and I, and she picked up a glass and swirled it in front of her nose and said, horseradish. Because I got her trained not to edit herself. And it turned out that bottle was a little corked. So it had that earthiness that you get from a little musty moldy that you get from horseradish. But it also had a kind of a spicy quality from maybe some terpene. I'm not exactly sure what the spicy was, but you put spicy and earthy together, that's horseradish, brother. You know, that is it. And so it was like one of those things. It's like, I'm sure she's like, I don't know why I'm saying this, but horseradish, you know. But again, you got to kind of let that part of your brain help you.
But all these factors, you know, throwing away the chemical data, gets thrown away by your brain, and then it triggers these random memories and everything. It makes it very, very hard a lot of times to pick up the individual components, right?
Well, they're not random. That's the thing. They're meaning.
Exactly, yeah.
And they're almost always associated with a place, right? That's the hippocampus likes that. It likes memories that have a place, you know, location. And so, you know, that's useful for animals, all of us to find food, you know, where this is, I smelled something good, or I had sex over here, or whatever it is, you know? So that's why it does it. That's why it, like, everything makes sense, but you got to see it from from an evolutionary point of view, from a species survival point of view. Once you kind of understand a little bit about that, then it's like everything makes perfect sense. We're just have expectations that it's going to, like, we're going to smell something and it's going to deliver a message on, like, on our phone, you know?
And yeah. I mean, I'm always sitting down and going, you know, I should be able to pick up DMS or esters or whatever it is out of the beer. But a lot of times it just never comes, you know?
Well, those are hard because we're all a little differently sensitive. And until you learn, like, when you're new at this, you know, you may not know what diacetyl is, or DMS is a hard one. It's a sulfur compound.
Yeah.
We habituate to it really rapidly. So you might smell something, you pick a glass up and you go, oh, there's something there. It's like kind of cabbagey or whatever, however you might describe it. And then you go back again and try and smell it again. And you can't smell it because you've already habituated to it, because it's a sulfur compound and we tend to habituate really rapidly to those. So you got to, like, reset, you know, smell something else, give it a rest. Put it down for a minute, come back to it, and then see. But then you know, part of the process of becoming a taster is you have to first come up with your own internal terms. Here's how I understand this. Like, acetaldehyde is a famously complex smell. It's a single chemical, but it triggers a pattern of responses just like smelling a whole beer. It's like a lot of different receptors. And the classic descriptor is green apple. For me, never. For me, the first time I actually figured out, like, oh, that's what this is, it smelled like a lawnmower that had just run over wet grass and rotten apples. And then some people say it smells like pumpkin guts, which it does, or latex paint, which it does, or flower shop, which it does. You know, DMS to some people smells like oysters. That's their cue for DMS. It's like, smells like a fresh oyster. I've never thought about DMS when I had an oyster in front of me. So I don't know, but and then you got to figure out, like, okay, here's my internal vocabulary. Now, what do the experts use? You know, wine people use different terms. They have all different framework.
Yeah.
That beer does. Beer, we have our styles based framework. With wine, it's all terroir based, varietal based, regional based, annually based. They have, you know, frameworks that they use that we don't really use with beer in the same way. So you got to learn the framework, and then you got to just learn the terms and put your own, like, okay, yes, flower shop, that's going to mean acetaldehyde, you know, and that's just part of the training process that it takes some time, right? It's not something you can't read a book and all of a sudden be good at this.
How can we train our brain to get better and better at judging beer? I know you've just mentioned some methods, but
Just do it. You know, and really, honestly, and one of the things is that your olfactory system is one of the only parts of the brain that's constantly being renovated. So your receptors in your nose are being renovated, and a lot of the cells in your olfactory bulb, those are regrown all the time. The ones in your nose, they have to be, because they're out there hanging. They're these little tiny little ends of cells, and they're hanging in the breeze, or really in the mucus, but they get a lot of abuse from there. It's physically just, they wear out, you know, they just can't survive. It's a really harsh environment, unprotected environment for them. And so, but it happens about every 2 weeks. So if you were to move all of a sudden from Virginia and moved to the Rocky Mountains to a cabin in the mountains, in 2 weeks, you'd be smelling all kinds of different things because you got all kinds of different things there to smell. Plants, different things. Like when they work with lab rats for smell experiments, they have to be very careful in how they raise them, because normally lab rats are raised in a odorously impoverished environment. They don't have a lot to smell, so they don't have experience with them. They don't even have a lot of receptors because they haven't had a use for them. You know, they get their chow every couple few times a day or whatever, but they don't have to be curious. They don't have to develop that. And so like with people who have COVID damage or other kinds of respiratory infections, and they get damage to their olfactory system, what they do is they get them to smell 5 or 6 different things, like peppermint and orange and butter, and like pick 2 or 3 other things and smell those several times a day, and sort of retrain your brain, right? And just get your brain used to doing it, get some new olfactory receptor cells going. And eventually that helps. It helps with people with, Parkinson's is actually associated with olfactory loss too. Hmm. And it'll help even those people. So, it really is just a matter of intentionality. And it's like anything, you know, you want to be strong, you got to exercise. You want to be a good taster. And really, I told this to Budweiser distributors, everybody I talk to, you want to be a taster, judge homebrew. You know, homebrew clubs are always looking for judges. They have competitions. They're a lot of fun to do. I've done a bunch of them. It's a great experience. You're with a bunch of friendly people. You spend all day and you are focused on the beer. And they keep bringing beer after beer. You got a score sheet. So you got to, and there's stakes there because the people are counting on you to give an honest account of what you're experiencing. So it really focuses the mind, and everything comes up in a homebrew competition. You're going to get all the chemicals, and you're also going to get yourself calibrated a bit, because if you're that guy that can't smell diacetyl, you know, and everybody else at the table or in the room is getting diacetyl from this thing, and you're just not getting it, at some point you got to conclude, I'm just not a very strong taster on diacetyl, or you might be a super taster on musty moldy or metallic or whatever it is, you know. So that knowing yourself and knowing what you're super sensitive to and what you're not that sensitive to is also really helpful.
Awesome. Well, Randy, thank you so much for being on the show. I did want to ask, can you mention your book title again and then the publisher? And I assume it's going to be several months probably before it's ready, right?
Oh, I would say probably at least a year.
A year, okay.
It's the University of Chicago Press. It's called Your Tasting Brain, How It Works and How to Use It. And I'm getting ready to, we're working on a new website, like kind of an author site. I'm going to start a newsletter. So, I'll be sending stuff out. If anybody's interested in getting on a newsletter, they can just hit me at randymosier.com and drop me a note, and I'll add you to it when I start sending those out.
Well, thank you, Randy, and I appreciate you being on the show, and I'm looking forward to your book. Maybe we can do another episode when you actually do get it on the market. But thanks again, Randy, for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I just love talking about this stuff, and I think it's so important for people's lives, you know. It just gives a lot of pleasure and makes the world a more wonderful place.
Well, today my guest is Randy Mosher, the author of the books Mastering Homebrew, Radical Brewing, and Tasting Beer. Thanks again, Randy.
Thank you, Brett.
A big thank you to Randy Mosher for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They invite you to join their upcoming brewery workshop, March 24th to 27th, in Austin, Texas. This one-of-a-kind event brings together professional brewers to help you start or grow your own craft brewery. To learn more, please visit breweryworkshop.com. Again, that's breweryworkshop.com. And also the American Homebrewers Association. The Homebrewers Association invites you to join today and get a bonus book. Join for 1 year and select from a free brewing book for more than 60 titles to match your fermentation goals. Visit homebrewersassociation.org to join the American Homebrewers Association today and treat yourself to a new brewing book. And I'm celebrating 20 years of Beersmith brewing software with a sale. I launched version 1.0 of Beersmith way back in the late fall of 2003, so this is my 20th year in business. And I'm running a Black Friday sale with 20% off until the 28th of November. Visit beersmith.com to take advantage of 20% off on Beersmith and Beersmith Web. And finally, a reminder to click that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show. I'd like to thank you for listening. I hope you have a great Brewing Week.